Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's January the 20th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Rising of the moon, there beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
Well, there's no new Edgar Steele news. So far as I know, the trial is still scheduled for March the 7th in Coeur d'Alene. The Steele family has now formed some kind of tax-free foundation in a desperate attempt to raise the necessary money to hire an independent audio expert to review the audio tapes or digitals or whatever the FBI has, wherein Ed Steele allegedly tries to hire Larry Fairfax to kill his wife and his mother-in-law. Apparently, Cindy Steele and the defense lawyer have had no success in raising the $250,000 it'll take to hire whatever expert it is they've approached, and that's where it all stands right now. We're just waiting for the trial, unless, of course, it's postponed again. Right, a week and a half now has gone by since the Arizona Judge and Jew shootings, and the dust has had a chance to settle, and we've actually got some facts to work on. It turns out that this Jared Loughner character was just your basic nut job. Very far from a white nationalist or a right-winger of any kind. Instead, he seems to be a typical trashed-out Beavis whose brain was fried to a crisp on drugs. He was, if anything, a left-winger and a Bush-hater, and indeed there's a good chance he may even be a Jew. He was apparently obsessed with this Jewish congresswoman as early as 2007, long before the Tea Party came along. The Democrats' efforts to turn the incident into some kind of conspiracy on the part of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and the Tea Party, and use it to revive the fairness doctrine to silence the regime's critics, are falling flat, since the facts of the case bear no resemblance of any kind to such a scenario, and even the media can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Limbaugh, especially, has totally deconstructed that crap on his show, and he has enough listeners to make it stick. It doesn't look like they'll succeed in blaming it on anybody else on our side of the fence, either. The Jared Taylor thing that popped up on Sunday was so far out there that it disappeared off the net after a couple of hours. I explained last week why that was ridiculous. Jared Taylor is not only not an anti-Semite, he has neocon rabbis speak at his conventions. And by the way, nobody ever did get back to me with any serious documentation on this accusation that Jared Taylor is married to a Jew. So until something concrete surfaces, we'll give Dr. Taylor the benefit of the doubt on that one. If anyone does have any actual, hard documentation that this is the case and that Jared Taylor is married to a Jew, I would very much appreciate it if they'd get in touch with me and show it to me. This is something I'd kind of like to know. Now, I myself was a little concerned after the Arizona incident because of that remark I made on the previous week's Radio Free Northwest. That was the one for January 6th. And what I said was something to the effect of, why is it that with all the gunning down of people on the streets that we Americans do over drugs or sex or money or just plain craziness, how come nobody who's really responsible for all this horror ever seems to get shot? I figured that might earn me a visit from our friends in the silk suits, but I guess it was just coincidence, or else my psychic gift of prophecy kicking in. Now, on this Jared Loughner as Jew business, a few words and you folks shall like ears. This brings up something I think I need to go over with you guys about the nature of, quote-unquote, our internet and the role it will play in coming events. I'm not certain where the Loeffner is a Jew thing first came up. Apparently one of this freak's dope-smoking friends was being interviewed by the media, and he made some comment to the effect that Loeffner once mentioned that he had a Jewish grandfather, or something of the kind, and that made it onto the internet. And of course, our own websites leaped all over it with both feet. Everybody and his kid brother was screaming, "Loeffner's a Jew! Loeffner's a Jew!" at the top of their lungs, and a lot of people were inquiring as to why I wasn't jumping on the bandwagon. Well, although I did, in fact, run one blog article on the topic, I reprinted an article that Michael Hoffman II wrote, I wasn't jumping on the bandwagon because the fact is that Jared Loeffner's Jewishness, or lack thereof, hasn't been confirmed by anyone or anything I would consider a reliable source, i.e. CNN or Fox News or the local Tucson paper or local TV station, nothing like that. And that is the kind of confirmation I need before I will commit myself on something like this. No, David Duke isn't good enough. No, Mother Jones isn't good enough. They're just as left-wing kooky as some of our own sites are kooky. I need to see an actual news story on something like this, not an unsourced blog. Not, I heard somebody over there say, somebody in Tucson said Obama's dog said Jared Loeffner is a Jew. I need a verifiable site, that's C-I-T-E, by an actual journalist, preferably one who follows the old-style double confirmation rule. I think Fox and MSNBC now demand only one. I went over this a few weeks ago, but let's take another stab at it. Now, the reason I want to wait until I get mainstream media confirmation on this is because, love 'em or hate 'em, and we all hate 'em, the mainstream media will almost never deliberately flat out lie or make things up out of whole cloth. Yes, I know, there have been some pretty spectacular exceptions to that, like that sheboon at the Washington Post who won a Pulitzer Prize with a story about an 8-year-old heroin addict that she made up, and the Dan Rather episode where he quoted non-existent military records to show that George W. Bush was a deserter, that kind of thing. But the Jews and the rabid leftists who control this country's news media understand that the weapon which they wield has only one thing that makes it powerful, and that's credibility. And they understand that they have to keep as much of it as they can. They are smart enough to understand that if they get caught in too many outright lies, they will no longer be effective. They'll no longer have an audience, and they will cease to exist. Now, this is to some extent what's happened with American newspapers. People get really tired of paying money to have liberalism, which is something they know is not true, forced down their throats. And that's one reason most people today have turned to either Fox on TV or to the internet, and Seattle now has only one raving left-wing newspaper instead of two. The media will distort facts. They will quote people out of context. They'll run the worst photos they can of somebody they don't like. They will chop up a half-hour interview into a 30-second soundbite to make someone look bad or stupid. And above all, they will lie by omission, by simply not reporting or grossly underreporting news events that should by rights be headlines. Indeed, I think it's quite possible that Jared Loeffner may indeed be a Jew, because the news media and the Tucson paper and TV have not specifically denied it, lying by omission. On the other hand, if Loeffner was a Catholic or a Lutheran, you could be sure the local media would mention it. So for what it's worth, in my opinion, yeah, there's a good chance he's a kike. But as for making stuff up, they don't do that. And most news media still require at least two separate confirmations on a story. On the other hand, quote-unquote, our news media on the internet tend to make up in enthusiasm what they lack in facts or accuracy, if you get my drift, and we need to change that. People, if we are going to undermine the mainstream media with the internet, and we can if we use it right, it's not just enough to generate a lot of noise and rumor. We have to get people to believe us. And then we have to get people turning to us for their news instead of to Fox or CNN or the Washington Post. We can't do that if we accuse everybody we don't like of being a Jew without some kind of documented and verifiable evidence. Now, God knows Jews do enough bad things already. If we make stuff up, especially stuff that later turns out to be wrong, then our websites are on the same level as the National Enquirer. Now, the day will come when large masses of people will turn to us, the Northwest Front and others in the white racial nationalist world, for answers. And when that day comes, we have to be able to provide them with the truth, not just finger-pointing and rumor and ideologically-based versions of the facts as we think they should be rather than as they are. Okay, time for a few quick emails. Diane in Lapeer, Michigan writes, Dear HAC, did you see that nigger-run Detroit will be closing half their public schools? How will anybody be able to tell? Good one, Diane. Yes, it's true. Motown is about to close half of its public schools. But since Detroit is now virtually all black and its students are therefore incapable of learning anything anyway, who cares? I saw a news article on that to the effect that this is being done because the Detroit school system is $327 million in the hole. Not the city itself, the school system alone. Look, I have to ask, how can even niggers run up a $327 million deficit in a school district? I mean, the expenses are fairly up front, teachers and staff whose salaries are matters of public record, school lunches, etc. Okay, running a big city school system is an expensive undertaking, but $327 million in the hole? How in hell does that happen? Now, banking and financial shenanigans aside, as well as simple nigger embezzlement, is all part of the puzzle, I'm sure, but could it possibly be that there's almost no tax revenue in Detroit anymore? And why might that be? Could it be that the only type of citizen who bothers to pay taxes has fled from Detroit like a thing unclean? And what color might that person be? It all boils down to this. When white people flee, blacks can't govern themselves and they can't be trusted with other people's money. After 57 years of integration, what part of all this do we not understand? Matt in Virginia writes, Dear HAC, do you think the Republicans will be able to repeal Obamacare? Well, don't count on it, Matt. Yeah, they've introduced the bill, so at least for once an establishment party has kept their campaign promises. But the Republicans have no majority in the Senate, and even if they can somehow get the repeal bill through the upper house and get to the White House, Barry will just veto it. But with no Senate majority, they won't be able to override a presidential veto unless those insurance companies that Obamacare is designed to put out of business really spread some cash around. And this is going to be the story of the next 2 years, gridlock. And that's fine with me. With any luck, this whole thing will just crumble and the senators and the congressmen will be beaten and strangling one another in the aisles. But if the Republicans do have the moral courage to go after Obamacare, hey, more power to them, although I will believe it when I see it. The Republicans, even more so than the Democrats, have a tendency to have memories 6 inches long when it comes to campaign promises. Promises are for the rubes on election day, not something one keeps. But what you have to remember is that through some kind of weird, unwritten code or something, Congress and the federal government never repeal any of this liberal crap once it's passed. Social Security, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, Roe v. Wade, now sodomites in the military. All these things are now engraved in stone. No conservative opposition ever has or most likely ever will succeed in actually physically repealing any of this rubbish. Will the Republican class of 2011 be any different with all those Tea Party types in there? I wouldn't count on it, folks. I really wouldn't. I think we will be astounded at the speed with which the feel of a plush armchair under a Tea Party member's butt in the congressional lounge and the fine aroma of a good cigar and the taste of aged cognac and the riffle of a stack of $100 bills will turn the Tea Party Congress into the same old bunch of old boys and girls who were open for business as usual. Okay, we got another short audio file this week from Gretchen the Librarian talking about the joys of life under the elms in old New England.
Good evening, comrades. There are 4 reasons why I hesitate to bring up the subject of crime and violence. For one thing, I'm reluctant to find any profit in an act of crime. The other thing is that there are some crimes that fit our agenda better than others, and I don't like to feel as if I'm cherry-picking crimes. The other one is that I do tend to feel a bit vulnerable when I focus on the issue of crime. And really the most important issue, probably the main reason, is just the fact that I support migration in any case, regardless of crime or otherwise, even if there was no crime. But in any case, there have been two crimes in recent years that have occurred very locally that do fit into our issues a great deal. One of them, unfortunately, happened regarding a woman that I knew, really only as an acquaintance. I never got to know her terribly well. And what happened with that one is that even though she really should have been married to my boyfriend's brother because they had a son together, and in my book, once you have a son together and you're living together, my goodness, you should be married. But they had this very unstable relationship. They were always breaking up and going out and dating. And this woman, who ought to have been my sister-in-law, decided at one point she wanted to date a black man who had had a prior regarding a knife attack. And when she decided that she didn't want to date him anymore, he slit her throat. So that was one incident, and there's a memorial to her in a local parking lot. There's a nice tree planted in her memory. The second incident, which occurred just recently, was the stabbing death of a man who was a local waiter, and he was stabbed to death by six black youths. It turned out to be a pretty much an open and shut case, and they haven't sentenced these six youths yet, as far as I know. But at any rate, the local response is, well, we need more sports, we need more recreation, there's a lot of bored young people in this town. There was a lot of crime in my town, and it's not a good idea to go out late at night. And it's really a good idea to have a security system at your home, and there have been several break-ins at my home, just in terms of our porch, and we had a car stolen. They've been peripheral break-ins, a break-in to the car. So now we have a security system. So, you know, it is a good idea to have the security system to keep your car in the garage and that sort of thing. You know, it's just another reason for me to eventually go to the homeland, even though the house that I live in is wonderful, the property is wonderful, and I'm going to miss it if I do decide to migrate, but I'm excited about going to the homeland also, and I'm so glad that Harold gives me this opportunity to be on his show. So thank you, Harold, for letting me be on the show so often. All right. Thank you for listening, comrades. Good night.
You know, Gretchen, you can say nigger on here. You ought to try it sometime, honey. It's a liberating experience. Now, this week, out of the blue, I got a song file from a comrade in England. It's a song that he wrote and recorded himself. It's called simply A Ballad for White People. This is Arland Bran.
White people.
I want to talk to you folks now about a phenomenon within the movement known as running away to join the circus. It's a problem that we don't have as much these days as we used to have, since circus-type groups are far more rare than they used to be. But nonetheless, it still happens on occasion. This is an email from one of our comrades in Idaho called Alaska Mike. Greetings, Harold. Okay, now that you're back, a couple of moderately important points. An update on Comrade X, and by the way, I'm not going to name this guy because it's not my intention to embarrass this man, and I certainly don't want to point him out to the system any more than he already is now. Anyway, back to Alaska Mike's email. He has joined a different KKK group out of Pennsylvania, and they protested at a taco stand in Aryan Nations-style uniforms that displayed an anti-Aryan Nations sign in Coeur d'Alene on Friday. I guess he's referring to the taco stand that had the anti-Aryan Nations sign. And they got a 15-second blurb on the Spokane ABC affiliate Friday evening, and the SPIC closed down for the day. They're also going to protest against Martin Luther King on his day. Anyway, I've been in a bad mood for a week because of my inability to get this person aboard the Northwest Imperative Program. He says he wants to be in a group that does something, and I can't complain about that. And other than our organizing and networking, I couldn't give him any specific plan. I may well have missed it. But how about giving us some activism stuff suggestions? No costumes and street walking is more limited. No bridges have been burned, and someone with people skills, unlike a reclusive old coot sniper technocrat like me, could still bring them aboard. He does know a lot of local racialists, is in the homeland, and wants to be active, and so could be a valuable asset. Signed, Alaska Mike. In other words, this gentleman in Idaho has done what we call running away to join the circus. He has put on a costume and made a clown out of himself. He has also made sure that if the local police didn't know about him beforehand, which, as it happens, they did, because I know this man did something prior to this to obtain publicity, and then they damn sure know about him now. Now, this gentleman has now placed himself on the police lists, and if from now on anything should happen in northern Idaho, like some idiot skinhead throwing rocks through a synagogue window, or spray painting a Jewish community center, or even worse, kicking over headstones in a Jewish cemetery, or hanging a toy monkey where a nigger can see it, that kind of thing, if and when that happens, this gentleman who picketed the taco stand will have cops on his doorstep first thing, pressuring him to talk to them and cooperate and name names. Now, if that happens, he'll have reporters coming around to his house as well at all hours when they're short of a story, and they'll be shoving cameras in his face when he steps outside. Now, this gentleman may be one of these exhibitionists who seeks out this kind of notoriety, but he's going to find, as I found back in 1979 and 1980 when I had my 15 minutes, that this bullshit gets old very fast. I can't recall if Alaska Mike ever mentioned to me what this man's job is, but I think he may be in for an unpleasant surprise once he starts getting media publicity. This man may believe that he has a good relationship with his boss and that his job is secure. Well, it may be. Let's give it 6 months and see how his employer responds to the kind of pressure that can be brought against any North Idaho company employing a known racist. Pressure from the Jews, pressure from the Chamber of Commerce, pressure from the cops. Pressure from the big real estate developer, Tim What's-His-Name, who was largely responsible for the attack on Pastor Butler because he was worried that the presence of the Aryan Nations would lower his extensive commercial property values. But I understand the frustration and the attitude about, oh, Harold, the Northwest Front ain't doing nothing. Gotta do something, gotta do something, gotta jump up and down and shit snowballs. Doesn't matter, just gotta do something. I get it all the time. People who are so desperate to get some kind of feeling of accomplishment, to find some way to fast forward the tape, are so desperate to do something that they end up doing the wrong thing, or perhaps a better way to put it would be that they end up doing the same thing that we have been doing for the past 70 years and which does not work worth a damn. Now, this movement of ours suffers from an almost fatal lack of imagination. When push comes to shove, usually all we can think of to do is dress up in a costume and stand on a street corner with a sign in our hands, thus allowing the local police and media to get our picture and our license number and making sure that whatever use we might be in the future as a public spokesman, we are now useless as a serious revolutionary because the police know who we are. Standing on a street corner wearing some kind of strange garb and holding a sign is kind of a political suicide as far as serious revolution goes. It takes you out of the game. And now, let me digress a bit here. Before some moron, cognitive dissonance agent on Facebook or Occidental Dissent leaps onto the internet screaming that this is a contradiction of a post I made on Facebook about a week or so ago. That post was about anonymous trolls. This is a case of apples and oranges. I was talking there in that post about trolls on the internet who hide behind false names in order to stir and to make trouble, i.e. Cass Sunstein's employees and ADL internet spooks like the ones who follow me around cyberspace in order to do harm to me and to the Northwest. I'm referring here in this podcast to real white people in the real world who seriously want to bring about change and who do need to protect their identities. It's nothing to do with the internet. The people I'm referring to are real. The internet trolls are not. The internet and real-world political activity have nothing to do with each other. Apples and oranges. Okay, let me explain a few things here. One of the racially conscious community's most durable and sacrosanct sacred cows is the street walk, otherwise known almost always incorrectly as a demonstration or a rally. 18 people do not constitute a rally of any kind, although the Jew and the scumbag counter-demonstrations are often sufficiently large to merit that designation. Before we go any further, I need to add here, by way of full disclosure, that for the first 8 years or so of my racial career, I wore a costume myself. So I've been there and I've done that, but I grew out of it. One of the signs of political maturity in a movement person is when you finally realize that it isn't a uniform, it's a costume. Took me 8 years to realize that, but then I'm a slow learner. Streetwalking in its present racial form in America, we're not talking about Europe here, Europe's a totally different kettle of fish, but streetwalking in America goes back to the famous Commander George Lincoln Rockwell and his early stormtrooper activities in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. Since Rockwell was so far head and shoulders above everyone else that the movement has subsequently produced by way of leadership, self-appointed or otherwise, it's understandable that a lot of misconception and distortion has attached itself to the Rockwell legend. And one of the more unfortunate beliefs that has embedded itself in our little subculture from the Rockwell era is this concept of the minuscule activity on public property where we don't control access or security or anything, and we go out dressed in some kind of odd garb or costume, and yet this has become kind of a defining rite of passage or manhood ritual. Are you a coward if you don't stand out on a street corner wearing a costume and let people throw rocks at you? Now, this is a complete incorrect reading of George Lincoln Rockwell's tactics, which, just as much as Weimar, were distinct and particular to his time and place, a time and place that is now half a century distant. What Rockwell did during Phase One was a temporary set of tactics, not a strategy, which Rockwell himself defined repeatedly and very clearly as publicity stunts to be used only during the earliest phases of the ANP's struggle. These publicity stunts, this whole Phase One thing, has become a kind of cult among racially aware whites. Nonetheless, streetwalking is still with us. Let me explain the official rationale behind streetwalking point by point. Streetwalking, in theory, is essentially an attempt to reproduce here in America certain specific objective conditions which apply to Europe today, or which have applied to Europe in the past, or which to a limited extent used to apply to America in a largely idealized and incorrectly remembered past. I'm talking about things like the 50,000-man Klan marches in the 1920s, so forth and so on. More specifically, streetwalking is an attempt to replicate here in the 21st century certain key periods in European history that provided windows of opportunity for revolution, specifically Weimar Germany of the 1920s and 1930s, and to a lesser extent, Petrograd in 1917 if you're a leftist. And by the way, lefties have this same obsession as well with running around in the streets. It's a form of what anthropologists call sympathetic magic. The belief is that if we emulate the behavior of certain political movements from these historical epochs and we put on an approximate pastiche of the costume of the period, then somehow the year 2011 will become these historical epochs. Now, here's how it's supposed to work in theory. Number one, we begin with a small number of people, mostly socially dysfunctional young men, plus a few older right-wing cranks like me. Guys, I'm sorry, but those of you who have actually attended these gigs, you're going to recognize the truth of what I say here. Now, this small handful of people then goes out in public, often oddly dressed and waving signs and flags from the various historical epochs that they're trying to invoke, and under the protection of the police, of the very government that they are supposedly trying to oppose and replace. They exchange shouts and shoves, and they throw things at the Reds and the Mud People and the Bugger Boys. And in actual fact, of course, most of the throwing of stuff is usually done by the enemy. And more often than not, our people come back from these activities with their robes and their costumes covered with filth. Now, secondly, this street theater generates establishment media publicity, which, according to Orthodox movement thinking, is the be-all, the end-all, and the absolute lifeblood of our struggle. According to this school of thought, to be on TV is to be real. That's the goods. That's the real stuff, the right stuff. True, we can usually get a few sound bites on the 6 and 11 o'clock news with these activities, and sometimes a couple of hourly mentions on CNN and a few mangled newspaper quotes as well. In theory, other white people will see all this publicity, they'll admire the hell out of us, and they'll all come clamoring to join our little group and go on the next such activity. Now, here's where the whole concept starts to slip, but let's leave that for later. With every new street walk, there will, in theory, be more and more white people wearing the costumes and waving the signs and the flags and screaming and shouting at the Reds and the Bugger Boys and the Muds. And eventually, there will be thousands more of us, and we will outnumber the scum. And then somehow, we magically skip over the next 20 or so steps. Revolution will automatically occur just because we have a few thousand more people walking down the street. And then we can all go back home, plop down on the sofa, pop the top on a cold one, and turn on the TV for the rest of our lives. Now, up to this point, all of this stuff is theoretically possible. And yes, I'm well aware that on a handful of occasions, like Gage Park in 1966 and Marquette Park in 1970 in Chicago and Glenn Miller's White Patriot Party, Forsyth County, Georgia, so forth and so on, we've even gotten to within faintly audible shouting distance of this point on the horizon. Now, I know because I was there for some of these events, and yes, it is possible for us to occasionally work up a fairly big crowd. Now, on those few occasions when we have reached that point, the whole project has always fallen apart due to one of two causes. First off, there's the issue of our own character, which we as a community steadfastly refuse to confront. Glenn Miller's a good example here. Now then there's also the complete and total lack of anything remotely resembling a plan to transmute large gatherings of racially aware whites into a political force that will transfer state power from the hands of those who presently hold it into our own. But usually the process is broken down long before at step three. The necessary connection isn't made in the minds of the white masses. The necessary desire to emulate and to join the streetwalkers never makes its appearance. Why not? Well, there are two reasons for this. First off, there's the fact that the Zog media controls what, if anything, the white community is allowed to see and hear of such activities. Now, like all serious stories nowadays, we are presented, whenever we go out in public, not as news, but as entertainment, which is what the masses expect now from television.
Look at the funny racists in the funny clothes. Oh, isn't that cute? Now stay tuned for American Idol.
Now, does this mean that we would get any better results if all the streetwalkers wore suits and ties? No, because secondly, there is again that issue of white character, which we refuse to address. The uncomfortable fact that we never want to deal with when we're doing this streetwalking mess as a substitution for action is that the overwhelming majority of white people are simply morally incapable of giving us the kind of reaction that we want from them. We are speaking to their grandfathers when we do this kind of thing, not to them. Modern-day Beavis and Butthead are a moral void. It is useless to appeal to the nobler natures and better instincts of the white majority. They have none. They've been deliberately made that way. They will never respond to any kind of mass movement tactics because the necessary moral instincts, frames of reference, and cultural motivations have been socially engineered out of them. We are beating a dead horse trying to use mass tactics. Okay, now that's street walking in theory, but what are we really doing here? Attendez-vous, guys. Let's start with a little history lesson. Now, the core of this belief system is that rather than actually fighting and killing our enemies, as was the case throughout thousands of years of Aryan history, real white men, quote-unquote, now display their macho and their physical prowess by symbolic gesture in a kind of mock ritual combat, kind of like New Guinea headhunters or gorillas and chimpanzees in a zoo. This role-playing ritual includes dressing up in strange, historically apocryphal clothing like homemade costumes patterned after the SA uniforms of the Third Reich, historically inaccurate Ku Klux Klan robes of purple and bilious green, and more recently we've got shaven heads with body tattoos. Let's be honest, some of these so-called right-wing and racist outfits look really absurd. Those of you who remember Andrew Greenbaum's uniformed branch, quote-unquote, for the Knights of Freedom from about 12 years ago, recall that they resembled the village people. On the street, there's a lot of bellicose chanting and shouting and threats and slogans. We're like gorillas beating our chests, the hurling of rocks and bottles, and that can be painful, but so far never lethal. There's the mock half charges and the aggressive posturing, etc. In some respects, it's remarkably similar to the ritualistic but almost completely non-fatal quote-unquote wars between tribes of New Guinea headhunters, where they all line up in a meadow and they yell and scream and ukuk at each other and they, you know, make these little rushes and wave their little wooden spears and then they all go back and have a feast. And it seems to serve a similar purpose. You know, we have the bonding feast afterwards at the local Howard Johnson's or, you know, McDonald's or whatever. And wearing big tankards of ale are hoisted, and the enemy are all held to scorn, and boasts of great deeds of battle done during the day are proclaimed, etc., etc. Now, the participants in these streetwalking activities have come through an event which generated an adrenaline and pheromone rush similar to that produced by an actual battle, but with none of the risks. They can subsequently feel the sense of accomplishment and the increased self-esteem that comes from the illusory idea that they've fought back, that they're in the trenches and they're frontline soldiers. And this, I think, is the main attraction of streetwalking. It gives an inflated and false high, a feeling of self-esteem, a feeling that you really did something when in fact you didn't. You notice that no one is ever actually hurt. Not a single weapon is fired, no physical damage of any kind is inflicted on the enemy. And on Monday morning, everybody trudges back to their shipwork jobs, and all is as it was. Nothing changes, and everybody's happy. Now, on a few occasions, actual combat does break out, more by accident than anything else, but it's always short, and it's quickly broken up by the police. And then there are legal consequences, which far outweigh any advantage to be gained. Greensboro and the Palmer House in Chicago in 1977 are good examples of this. Now, before somebody starts yelling about November the 3rd, it needs to be very clearly understood that Greensboro was an accidental exception, totally sui generis, totally on its own. And we should note that it has not been allowed to happen again, thank God. No one but an idiot would want to go through the years that followed Greensboro as the lives of 16 innocent men were utterly destroyed by this society's obscene judicial process. The actual chance of anyone getting seriously hurt on one of these street walks beyond a few bruises is slim. The police are always out in force, and usually they more or less do their jobs and prevent the tiny handful of whites from being lynched by the lefty muddy mobs. There have been some nasty incidents at some of these events when they've been allowed to get out of hand or when the police are absent through design or incompetence, but even when that happens, there's never any serious threat to the power structure. If there were, the police would be breaking up such gatherings with rubber bullets and nightsticks and not guarding us. In essence, streetwalks are a psychological substitute for actual physical resistance against the tyranny that's destroying our race. It's rather like professional wrestling, ritualized mock combat that allows for a certain level of self-esteem in those who participate in these things. It's like exchanging insults and maybe a few shoves and pokes with scum is in some way equivalent to actual serious resistance, which threatens the power structure. Now, an interesting thing I noticed when I was in Ireland. Now, while Sinn Féin, the legal arm of the Provost, does hold demonstrations regularly in Dublin and Belfast and other places, in the first place, Sinn Féin has the many thousands in numbers that are needed to do it right. And secondly, the actual volunteers of the IRA are under orders to stay away from such events to prevent their being photographed or arrested. The only exceptions used to be firing parties at Republican funerals, although I understand the provost stopped doing that because it's too risky. In some ways, this cult of faults macho is perfectly understandable in view of the extreme rarity of physical courage among white males these days. I don't deny a certain limited value in these events. In the absence of a better rite of passage for young white men, this will have to do for the time being. Although, frankly, I think a better rite of passage for young white men would be learning a trade and raising a family in the homeland. But I have to admit, I like my own little aphorism about this. A white man of 20 who doesn't streetwalk has no balls. If he's still doing it when he's 40, he has no brain. Anyway, enough for the moment. Time for the second music break. I got a good response from those Missouri Civil War songs that our comrade in St. Louis sent me back in the early summer, so here's another one. And this is called Johnny Whistle Trigger. This is Kathy Barton and Dave Para.
1861, Whistle Trigger picked up his long tom gun. Went down south with old Pap Price, fighting for Missouri and for Southern rights. They whipped General Lyon down at Wilson's Creek, mopped up Lexington in just about a week. Things was getting hot for the Butternut Boys, hightailed it down into Arkansas. Run, Johnny Whistle Trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny Whistle Trigger, better get away. Run, Johnny Whistle Trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny Whistle Trigger, better get away. Johnny got a hankering to see his wife. He asked for a leave from old Pap Price. Pap said, Johnny, you can have your way. Be back next month by the 14th day. Johnny rode his mule both day and night, made it up to Boonville and looked up his wife. But early next morning at the break of day, Johnny woke up when he heard his wife say, Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away. They took Johnny prisoner and they marched him down to a fort they had built at the edge of the town. Put him to work with the kitchen crew. Johnny said, this'll never do. Late one night when the guard got drunk, Johnny took a chance and he showed his funk. He made a grab for his long tom gun, smacked that guard and he started to run. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away. He ran till he came to the river bluff pit, climbed on down and he hid in a cave. Early next morning, Johnny heard a man say, I think he's down there, don't let him get away. Johnny busted out and took him by surprise. His long tom caught a fella right between the eyes. He jumped in the river and he started to swim. The Union boys all shooting at him. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away. He swam on down to the Osage mouth, took that river and he headed on south. Just like he promised when he went away, reported into Pap on the 14th day. Old Pap made him a colonel on the spot. His friends was amazed that he hadn't got a shot. He said he owed it all to his long tom gun, knowing when to stand and knowing when to run. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, Federals will get you. Run, Johnny, whistle, trigger, better get away.
Mike, I haven't forgotten the second part of your email as to what exactly local organizers are supposed to do if they don't dress up and wave signs on street corners. And if you mean, can I micromanage this and tell you step by step what all of you have to do? No, I can't. No one can micromanage a revolution. No one can draw a complete and infallible blueprint for a revolution. There's no military saying no plan survives the first day of combat. No revolution ever follows a plan or a schedule or a book, mine included. This is one of those subjects where I know exactly what I want to say, and yet I can't say most of it in public for reasons which I'm sure will become apparent if you think about it. I'll do what I can, but I'm going to have to choose my words very carefully. Now, the first thing you all need to understand is that the Northwest Imperative is the real thing at last, or at least it's my intention that it be the real thing at last, and most of my present audience, I'm sure, has trouble wrapping their minds around that. I doubt if there's one person in 100 listening to this who truly believes that anyone can do this, that anyone can erase the handwriting on the wall for the white race. That makes it incredibly hard for me to do what I gotta do. Faith can move mountains, true, but first you have to have the faith. I can see the future Northwest Republic so clearly, but apparently I can't make others see it, at least not to the point where they're willing to undergo any risk or inconvenience. What we're trying to do here has only been attempted twice before in our nation's history, and of those two times, one was unsuccessful, and in any case, the circumstances were very different. In 1776 and 1861, the revolt against the central authority was led openly and by the leaders of the political and social institutions of the day. The governors and legislators, the doctors and lawyers and planters, the businessmen, the newspaper editors, the clergy. In other words, most of the existing establishment of the 13 colonies in the South. It was okay to stand up in public and say you were a Continental Patriot or a Southern Secessionist. These movements had the all-important element of social approval that the white man just can't seem to do without. What we're trying to do today here in the Northwest is to bring about change in the face of a repressive totalitarian state and all its apparatus, including the government, the military, the secret police, the media, most of the intelligentsia, the business and economic establishment, the whole enchilada of a corrupt regime. And we're trying to bring about this change from the very bottom of the scale. This is a huge and dangerous undertaking. Please don't ever think that I'm unaware of the magnitude of what I'm asking from you folks. Now, I know a lot of you probably ask yourselves, when is Harold Covington going to stop babbling on the internet for an hour every week and suddenly run into a phone booth and then leap out wearing a blue, white, and green Superman outfit and fly through the skies, leap a few tall buildings in a single bound, land in your neighborhood and make a fiery speech from a picnic table, and all of a sudden it's all just going to happen? Guys, all I can tell you is that in the real world, it just doesn't work like that. I repeat, this time we're going to have to really do it, because we're out of time and out of resources and out of people. And if we screw this up 100 years from now, there will be no more people who look like us anywhere in North America, and possibly not in the world. Every human being on this planet will be some kind of baby shit brown. Without white people to keep things going, this whole continent will be like Haiti and Somalia and Detroit are today. And then, in about 1,000 years, humanity really will be a bunch of dark-skinned, naked animals roaming the forests and plains like you see on prehistoric Discovery Channel shows, living off nuts and berries and grubs they dig up with a stick. If the white man departs, then that is what the nigger and the mestizo will go back to. All this, all we know, all we've made, will be gone. We have one chance only, remaining, and that is the Northwest Imperative. We cannot screw this up. That's why we have to learn from the mistakes of the past. The whole history of our movement is one long list of how not to do it, and running away and join the circus, going out in public dressed funny and doing weird jackass-style stuff pretty much tops the list of how not to do it. So how do we do it? Well, I've been telling you how on these podcasts for the past year. A revolution begins with an idea, true, but after that must come people. Right now, our every effort has to be concentrated on getting boots on the ground, as they say in the military. There are two ways we can do this, and we need to use both of them. First off, I have to somehow find the magic words to get through to you people who are listening to this from Cincinnati and New York and Florida and Nebraska and California and get you to come home. I need you to move here to the Northwest. Sink your roots and make your homes and make your lives here, forever. Total commitment to this land and to a free, independent nation. No more screwing around with ridiculous little clan groups or kosher conservatism or tea partyism or blogs or websites or costumes or single-issue politics. No running off in a little cabin in the woods to try and hide from Obama. That is not how to do it. I need to get you here. living in communities and functioning in society, and working to weave the safety net that will allow thousands of other white people to come here when their own neighborhoods and cities and states become majority non-white and unfit for human habitation. I need you to be a pioneer in the same sense that your ancestors were, because you'll be coming here off your own bat with nothing but your own skills and your willingness to work to see you through. I won't go off into my standard spiritual transformation rap, because if I do, we'll be here all night, but I've talked about this before, and you get the idea. Now, for those of you who already live here, okay, you want some micromanagement, you want somebody telling you what to do by the numbers, this is the best I can do, at least on here. First off, whatever you did when you were with the Klan, or with the Aryan Nations, or the Tea Party, or the Militia, or the Skinheads, or whoever, stop doing it. It's probably wrong. No, I'm not being funny. None of it has worked, and so it's wrong, and we need to shit-can it. Given the past 50 years of right-wing and racial failure, I think it's obvious we need to sit down and do a complete rethink here. Now, I know a lot of you are involved in other groups, or you were involved in other groups and movements and so on, and you most likely have picked up a lot of baggage and a lot of bad habits. We need to lose it. You need to deep-six all of it and start over. Secondly, I'll tell you the same thing I said earlier to these other people that are living outside the homeland. We need people. We need boots on the ground. We need to create actual communities of white nationalists who live within half an hour's drive of one another. Your duty as a Jerry Reb is to reproduce, to make other Jerry Rebs. All of the political stuff, all of the revolutionary stuff, the fun part, yes, it will come, but we have to lay the groundwork. I know this is what people just really, really don't want to hear, but the fact is, we are having to do things right now in the Northwest that should have been done 50 years ago, but they weren't, and we have to catch up. And until that foundation is laid, until we get an infrastructure, until we lay the groundwork, we can't fast forward the tape to the fun part. The Northwest idea itself needs to be spreading among white people who live here like a virus, but it isn't, because only a handful of people visit our websites every week, and because there doesn't seem to be hardly any word of mouth going on out there, at least insofar as I can tell from the responses I get here by mail and by email, and that has to change. Once a certain tipping point is reached, once people know we are here, then the Northwest idea really will go viral, as the saying goes, and then it'll be unstoppable. At any given time, any really dedicated Northwest nationalist who lives here should be personally working at least half a dozen potential new recruits. Personally, face-to-face, hands-on, by talking to them. What is our party's primary tool? Our website. Get northwestfront.org in front of every white person you possibly can, however you can. And when most of those people ignore you, as they will, stick it in front of them again. And when they ignore you again, find a way somehow to keep getting that URL under their noses until finally they get curious and go there. That's the first step. Now, my Northwest novels are expensive, almost $20 a piece, and I apologize for that, but there's no help for it. You need to keep a few on hand, and anytime you find somebody who might be of some value to the movement and who doesn't appear to be completely illiterate, pester them until they read one of the books. If the brigade is too big and thick, start them off with one of the other three. They're shorter. Repeatedly over the past months, I have begged you guys to unleash your Aryan creativity by producing short, handheld items like leaflets, stickers, and business cards for the Northwest Front, things that are attractive and colorful and explain our worldview in a few simple phrases. I've been kind of disappointed with the results, except in a few cases like our new unit down in Salem. Now, if you want to use the leaflets that I send out in the intro packs, fine. Let me know, and I will send you some by email or by mail. If you don't like those, then make your own, but you should never be without small NF items to distribute or give to individuals. If you want to start your own internet radio show like this one, by all means, do so. It's not chiseled in granite that my voice is the only one to be heard in the Northwest. Remember, at this point in time, your primary task is to bring in new people living here in the homeland and then get them to spreading the Northwest idea. It's called the multiplier effect. Think of it as kind of an Amway multi-level marketing program, only instead of shampoo and vitamins, you're selling a much better product. You're securing the existence of your people and a future for white children. I've gone over all this before, and I'm sure I'm starting to sound like a broken record, so we'll take our last music break. But for some reason, I feel like a grim and ghoulish old ballad this evening. You know, back in the old days, most people were interested in pretty much the same thing people are interested in today. Gossip and scandal and sex and violence and crime and horror. They didn't have the National Enquirer or TMZ.com, but they did have minstrels, ballads, and later on the theater. That's the reason why, in addition to his immortal prose, Shakespeare's plays are so full of violence and murder and sword fights and ghosts and all that good stuff. The Elizabethans would have considered James Bond to be the height of great literature. Now, I played a number of these ballads on Radio Free Northwest over the past year. Let me look back over my list here. There's been all kinds of murder, of course, including either two or three versions I played of The Cruel Sister, including one by Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. There was A Demon Lover in The Holland Handkerchief. We had Sex and Child Murder in that Ian and Sylvia song I played a few weeks ago. Underage Sex and Young Death in The Trees That Do Grow High. Another Ghost Lover and She Moved to the Fair. Death by Disease and Suicide in Barbara Allen. Gallows Song in Roddy McCorley. Supernatural Sex in The Witch of the Westmoreland. Witchcraft and Hanging in Susanna Martin. Okay, let's see what I haven't played yet. Right. We have Incest and Child Murder in The Well Below the Valley, Child Murder and a Hanging in Mary Hamilton, Pregnant Girlfriend Murder in Pretty Polly, Burning at the Stake in Bonnie Susie Clellan. Oh, here we go. Incest, Suicide, A Ghost, and Necrophilia. Yeah, that'll do it. This song is called Little Margaret, and believe it or not, it's one of the oldest known ballads in the British Isles. I remember some chronicler or other referring to an early version of this song in the 11th century. That version was probably strummed on a harp or plunked on a lute, but this is a little bit more of a modern version, and it's sung by the immortal Walter Forbes.
Little Margaret is sitting in her high hall chair, combing her long yellow hair. When she saw sweet William and his newlywed bride coming down the road so near, she threw down her ivory comb, threw back her long yellow hair, saying, "I'll just go and bid him farewell, nevermore to go there." It was all lately in the night, when they were fast asleep, little Margaret appeared all dressed in white, standing at their bed feet. Says, "How do you like your snow white pillow? How do you like your sheet? And how do you like the pretty little damsel lying in your arms asleep? Quite well I like my snow white pillow. Well I like my sheet. Much better I like the pretty little maiden standing at my bed feet." For serving men to go, saddle up his dapple roan, and he rode straight away to his father's house, knocked on the door alone. His little Margaret in her room, or is she in the hall? Little Margaret's a-lying in a cold, dark coffin, her face turned to the wall. Unwind those snow-white robes, be they ever so fine. I must kiss those cold, cold lips, I know they'll never kiss mine. Once he kissed that he kissed that cheek. 3 times he kissed those cold, cold lips, then he fell in her arms asleep. 3 times he kissed those cold, cold lips, then he fell in her arms asleep.
Mike, I know it probably sounds to you like I didn't answer your question fully. If it helps at all, I myself am working on several projects that will hopefully begin to generate at least a little bit of mainstream media publicity over the next year. And if we can ever manage to get into the news, then that'll certainly give guys like you out there on the ground some help and a hook to bring people in with. Like I said, I know in my mind what I want to say here. But it probably isn't a good idea for me to spell things out explicitly, so if you'll bear with me for a bit, there are a few books I'd like to recommend that you and other people within the homeland itself read. Not so much for specific items of information, although you'll find a lot of that if you read these books right, but to convey something to you. Not just part of what's gone into my own vision, but a kind of state of mind that the Northwest Front local organizer has to have. It's unfortunate that the best books about revolution always seem to be written by communists, and I know a lot of our people have trouble making that leap, so I won't recommend any of those. First, I'd like you to locate online a book called The Irish War of Independence by Michael Hopkinson. The thing about this book is that you'll see that what I'm writing about in the Brigade and my other books can be done. Not because my allegedly brilliant writing says so, but because, in fact, it has been done. It was done 90 years ago in Ireland, in what is probably the closest historic parallel to white people's situation in this country. Now, I told you before that faith can move mountains, but first you have to have the faith. When you understand that what I'm asking of you is not impossible, that another white nation accomplished it almost within living memory, I hope that'll give all of you a boost on the faith front. The second book, or actually it's a short novel I'd like you to get hold of and read, is a work by the science fiction writer Robert A. Heinlein. The title is If This Goes On, and you'll probably find it in a collection of Heinlein's short works entitled Revolt in 2100. It's a fictional account of a revolution in the future, and I won't try to describe it except that it's told in the first person by a member of an underground conspiracy named John Lyle, and it's one of the best descriptions of the mindset and the attitude and the indomitable spirit of a revolutionary in existence, I think. You may have to go online to Alibris.com or someplace like that to find this one. It may be out of print, but believe me, it's worth tracking down. Finally, I want you to obtain and read as many of the spy novels of John le Carré as you can. I know a lot of people think I'm just being dotty and eccentric about that, but what you'll learn in these books is the whole concept of life as a spy behind enemy lines, and that is what you are if you're a white nationalist in the Northwest. People, I'm dead serious here. The Northwest Front organizers have to be active, they have to accomplish their mission, which at the moment is to get more nationalist boots on the ground in the homeland, but they have to do so while preserving their own covers and keeping the occupation forces as much in the dark as possible about their identity and their activities. Because the time may well come when something really heavy comes down and some U.S. Attorney General gives the order to round us all up. And when that happens, I wonder how many people are going to end up in an internment camp because back in 1993, they attended an Aryan Nations Congress and some informer picked up on their identity. Comrades, never forget that although we may not be technically outlawed yet, the knowledge that we have and the idea that we seek to spread among white people in the Northwest is forbidden. The tyrant's regime does not want us doing what we're doing. They don't want us speaking to others about what we believe. And they don't want us thinking what we are thinking. Constitution and law aside, when they become sufficiently annoyed with us for thinking and speaking and believing that which they forbid, they will find some way to suppress us. The Northwest Front is a legal movement that must act as if it was an illegal one. And that means that most of our organizing must be done on a covert level. We have to win over others to our cause. But we need to conceal what we're doing from the enemy. and we need to prepare ourselves for the day when at long last we can resist this terrible tyranny with something other than words. Until that time comes, all I really know to say to you all is trust me, believe, work for the 14 words, and wait. I know it's not what you want to hear, but it's what you have to do, because this really is the real thing, people, and we will only get one chance at it. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.
Follow in their footsteps of the rising moon.